When you haven't found love, it can feel like everyone else has. It's in every movie, every song, and all the PDA. Looking for love sucks. Thankfully, California Psychics can give you the guidance you need to find the one. We guarantee, if your reading isn't life-changing, it's free. And new customers receive 20 minutes for just $20. Visit CaliforniaPsychics.com and experience the joy of certainty. California Psychics.
Are you ready to dive into the stories, stats, and personalities that make baseball the greatest game in the world? Rob Bradford from the Baseballs and Boring podcast here, and we'll have you covered every day with podcasts that bring you closer to the action, from the bleachers to the clubhouse. Whether you're a diehard fan or just a casual observer, these conversations are aimed to educate, entertain, and most importantly, inform you. Follow the Baseballs and Boring podcast in the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's the Amazing Rico Bronya Podcast with your host, Evan Roberts.
For the first time in a while, it's a sweep edition of Rico Bronya. And I mean one of those good sweeps, you know? One of the sweeps where we do the sweeping, not getting swept by the Pittsburgh Pirates or getting swept by the Tampa Bay Rays. The New York Mets take care of business. They sweep the Angels of Anaheim. It wasn't easy. It wasn't pretty. It took some luck in the final game of this series. It took some horrific umpiring as the Mets held down for dear life and won 6-3. In the first two games of this series, it featured comebacks. It featured some terrible Angels defense. But the one thing I've learned over the course of 162 games is beggars can't be choosers. So I'm not going to sit here for an hour and tell you about how lucky the Mets are. Were the Mets lucky? Sure. Absolutely. Luck plays a part of baseball. And there was some luck involved in the three wins they got against the Angels. But over the course of 162 games, you take your wins and you run with them. And so no matter how you win a baseball game, whether it's because of the ineptitude of your opponent or it's the ineptitude of umpiring, you take it, you run, you have a smile on your face. And considering the unevenness of the way this team has played for a while, to be able to put together three consecutive victories against the Angels, four consecutive victories overall, making this a successful homestand. They went 4-2, which is what I wanted, what most of us wanted before the homestand began. Go get me 4-2. It happened in a peculiar way, losing the first two, but all in all, wins are wins are wins. And from a record standpoint, the Mets are in a good spot. We're going to recap the final two games of this series. If you're curious about thoughts from the opener, the dramatic Met comeback that they put together, I would say download episode 516. That was also the episode where we analyzed every word from David Stearns and his press conference the other day. But we also gave some deep thoughts on the opener of this series. Game three, the finale on Wednesday afternoon, it was important. It wasn't one of those, we won the series. Great. This was a chance to sweep a series, have a good winning streak going into the break, and you had a significant pitching edge going into the game. You know, Sean Manaea has only pitched twice. I think he's been impressive in both games. The first one, obviously, out of the bullpen. The second one, he didn't go deep into the game, but he was effective when he was out there. But you have Sean Manaea, and you've got the Angels essentially throwing a bullpen game at you. That's what we were staring at. And so when you see that, you say, this is the game where you're supposed to win. This is the game where you're supposed to jump all over them. And when you look at the first inning of this game, could you have written a better script? You have Sean Manaea coming out in the first inning of this game looking as dominant as we've ever seen him. Striking out Zach Neto to start the game, striking out the second place hitter, striking out Mike Trout. A 1-2-3 domination from Sean Manaea. And then you combine it with the fact that Brandon Nimmo, who has really been their most consistent hitter during this uneven stretch that they're dealing with, Soto's been streaky. We know about Lindor's streak. Alonso's been slumping. I mean, honestly, their most consistent hitter during the unevenness has either been Brandon Nimmo or Brett Beatty. Take your pick. What a tone-setting home run by Nimmo when you combine Manaea striking out the side to start the game And then Brandon Nimmo jumping on a slider right down the middle from the opener, Brock Burke, and depositing one into the right field seats. Absolute tone-setting moment for Brandon Nimmo. After that, we saw a very shaky Sean Manaea. Now, credit to Sean Manaea. At the end of the day, five innings, one run. Obviously, he is going to eventually need to expand that pitch count and go deeper into games. It's something he talked about post-game. But after that first inning, where Manaea looked unhittable, he really did struggle. I mean, you look at the second inning of this game, which he got through without giving up a run. He gives up the base hit to Taylor Ward. He walks Joe Adell. He ended up walking Renjifo, which loaded up the bases for Chris Taylor. But luckily, and it's a credit to Manaea and what he was able to do in this game, he falls behind Chris Taylor 2-0, bases loaded, two out, dangerous spot, gets a big out. He unfortunately gives up the home run to Mike Trout, which I guess was cool for some people there, because now you get to tell your kids or your grandkids that you saw Mike Trout hit a home run. And from that standpoint, I guess it's cool. But at 1-1 in the bottom of the third inning, in a game in which Manaea's pitch count is now starting to jump and you're facing the Angel bullpen, there is a little like, come on, guys. Can we jump on this team? I know the offense has been limp for the most part. But if there's ever a game where you can just make this easy and score a bunch of runs, you figure this would be the game. And in the bottom of the third inning, we saw some very, very important things. Tyrone Taylor draws a walk. Brandon Nimmo gets hit by a pitch. And then Francisco Lindor ended our national nightmare. And my biggest hope when Lindor drove that RBI single to make it 2-1, give the Mets the lead, a lead they would not relinquish. So kind of like in hockey, the game-winning goal, the game-winning hit in the Mets' case occurred in the bottom of the third inning. The hope is this turns into Lindor getting hot. And even if it's not some kind of crazy MVP pace like he did last year, at least be reasonable. Because the last month, has it been a month? Yeah, I mean, kind of. The last month has been such a struggle. And, you know, sometimes it's a cliche when you say a team goes as far as a certain player. But the reality is the Mets go as far as Francisco Lindor. That has been kind of the reality of the last couple of years. So when he drove in that run, and it was a weird moment when he drove in that run, because it was that moment I was leaving my office to go into the studio and do a radio show, one of the perils of afternoon baseball. So I was like moving very quickly from my office to the studio just to see what was going on. But that was a huge hit for him. It was great how the crowd reacted. I think the crowd has been incredibly supportive of Lindor. He heard a few boos on David Wright Day. I had mentioned that. But for the most part, considering the 0 for 30 or 0 for 31, whatever it eventually got to, I lost count. His Rico net negative award that he won from the Cincinnati series, sometimes it takes one. And you could feel the last few days that he was making better contact. And I know we don't want to hear that necessarily because it's a results business, but there was kind of more moments where Lindor didn't look overwhelmed. He wasn't flailing at pitches in the dirt. He wasn't striking out. Like, you could feel this was coming. But obviously the big moment, and maybe the bigger moment from that inning after Soto popped up meekly with runners in scoring position, what else is new, was Pete Alonso. Because while Lindor has gotten a lot of the attention for his slump, Pete's been a mess. He's been a colossal mess. It is kind of amazing that the Mets have found ways to win games, a few games, despite getting absolutely nothing from their best hitters. You know, we talked about that at the end of the Cincinnati series, how Alonso, Lindor, and Soto were a combined, what was the number again? Like 3 for 40 or 2 for 40 in that series against Cincinnati. And it was almost amazing they won a game. And that slump really continued until that third inning on Wednesday. The Lindor RBI hit to make it 2-1, and then Pete hitting an absolute bomb of a three-run home run that broke the game open and made it 5-1. And it was mammoth. And you could tell with the way Alonso pimped it, like he totally pimped the daylights out of that home run. And that was a guy who was letting out aggression. That was a guy saying, all right, I'm pumped up. Let's go. And then you tack on Lindor an inning later, driving in another run, another base hit. So he goes 0 for over 30 and then gives you back-to-back base hits. The negative at 6-1 was that was it for the offense. And I can't tell you how many times that happens. Where the offense breaks out, you feel pretty good about it. Like, all right, here we go. And not that I needed them to score 5 more runs or 4 more runs, but especially as the Angels tightened it up in the 7th inning. In the bottom of the 7th inning, you have Lindor, Soto, and Alonso coming up. And the hope is, all right, just respond. Because now it's a 6-3 game. Things are getting a little dicey. You knew Diaz would be available, but you also knew that other guys weren't going to be available. Reed Garrett wasn't going to be available. Ryan Stanek wasn't going to be available. So that was the disappointing thing, that the offense couldn't add anything. The other disappointing thing was obviously the Met bullpen, specifically Jose Buteau. He'd really be the one guy you'd kind of knock. His return from his illness, whatever it was very, very shaky. Brooks Raley wasn't amazing. He walked multiple guys, but was able to make the big pitch when he needed to. And then you've got Edwin Diaz. And I thought that Mendy managed the 8th inning perfectly. Like, I love the fact that he goes to Raley when he did in the 7th with the lefty and then Trout coming up. And after he walks Chanel, he gets Trout out. So he makes a very big pitch against Mike Trout. I think that was the excuse me swing, if memory serves correct. He gets 2 outs in the 8th inning, but after he gets Logan Ohapi out, so he gets the 2nd out, going to Diaz made perfect sense. I like Edwin Diaz in those 4 or 5 out save situations. Like, for the most part, he's done a good job. I know his recent blown save occurred when he came in the 8th inning, but let's not pretend like he always struggles in the 8th inning. That's not the case. He can pitch in the 8th inning. And knowing there was an off day on Thursday, it's the perfect time to kind of unleash what you have. And Edwin was shaky. Like, Edwin's last performance was dominant the first game against the Angels when he struck out the side. He looked filthy. That was hey, if you guys were concerned about my blown save, you got nothing to worry about. Think about what he does when he comes in 3-run lead, 1 on, 2 out. So he's in a spot where he's got to put a guy on base for the tying run to come up. He gets ahead of Travis d'Arnaud and then hits him with a slider. So the at-bat began in a positive way, where he gets ahead. He throws a first-pitch strike, which earlier in the year Diaz would struggle with. He gets ahead of him, hits him with a slider, and I'm sorry. Like, it's okay to accept bad calls. It's like taking a gift. Like, thank you for the gift. You didn't have to, but thank you for the gift. The Diaz-Renjifo at-bat now as the tying run with 2 outs in the 8th inning was an umpiring masterclass on badness. Edwin Diaz threw 6 pitches to Luis Renjifo. Renjifo did not swing at any of these pitches, okay? So he did not take the bat off his shoulder one time. Diaz threw 6 pitches. They were all balls. And they were all basically in the same spot, 6 inches off the plate. On the outside part of the strike zone to a switch hitter batting left. 6. Bing, 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 bing. I think they were all sliders. And they were all outside. And I don't know what Eric Bacchus was doing. I guess give him credit for being consistent, because the 3 strikes he called on Renjifo, they were all in the same spot. So from that perspective, he was consistent, but that was atrocious. And I'm not throwing it back. Like, I don't know what that inning was going to look like if Eric Bacchus actually called what they should have been, which was balls. Because all of a sudden, if he walks Renjifo, the bases are going to be loaded with 2 outs for Zach Nato. And I don't know what happens, especially after Diaz walks a guy on 4 or 5 pitches, depending on if Bacchus was going to take any of those strikes back. But the umpiring was atrocious. And that's okay. You know, if we were on the other side, would we be bitching about it? Yeah, we would be. But not my problem. What was going to be important after the Mets did nothing in the 9th inning or the bottom of the 8th inning was can Diaz settle down in the ninth inning? Can he come in after getting that break and just make this an easy ninth inning? And the first thing he did was hit Chris Taylor. It's the first thing he did. So I guess Neto wouldn't have come up with the bases loaded now that I'm thinking. So it would have been bases loaded for Chris Taylor. But he hits the first guy he faces. Luckily, after that, he strikes out Neto. He gets Chanel to ground out. He gets Mike Trout to pop up. And Edwin Diaz secures the four-out save. And the Mets get themselves a nice, neat, and tidy victory. It was sort of nerve-wracking, especially when the Angels bring the tying run to the plate, which they were able to do in the eighth inning of that game after Diaz ran into the issues he was running into. But a win's a win. And it was a good victory. And it was probably a more comfortable victory than certainly the first two games of this series because, you know, we talked a lot about game one. I mentioned that's episode 516 of the Rico. You look at game two of this series, it kind of followed the same script. Soler hits that laser beam home run off Frankie Montas. They tack on another run on an RBI double by Chanel in the fifth inning. And so Frankie's throwing a decent game, but the Met offense, like always, is doing nothing. And they're doing nothing against the guy in Kyle Hendricks, who's so incredibly frustrating because he doesn't throw hard. He looks hittable. And it's always been the case like that with Hendricks, even his days in Chicago. But now in Anaheim, you look at his numbers, and the numbers back up that he's not that difficult to hit. He's got a 5 ERA. And yet the Met offense, led by the top of the batting order, led by the guys that are supposed to produce, did nothing. You know, Pete Alonso, I mentioned Lindor showed he was close with a couple of hard hit balls. Pete also showed he was close because in the second inning of that game, he hit a ball to right center field that I thought off the bat was getting out. At the minimum, it was going to be a double in the corner. And Joe Adele made this incredible play.
Are you ready to dive into the stories, stats, and personalities that make baseball the greatest game in the world? Rob Bradford from the Baseballs and Boring podcast here, and we'll have you covered every day with podcasts that bring you closer to the action, from the bleachers to the clubhouse. Whether you're a diehard fan or just a casual observer, these conversations are aimed to educate, entertain, and most importantly, inform you. Follow the Baseballs and Boring podcast in the free audio the app or wherever you get your podcast.
Like, boy, if the Angels were going to trade some of their players, I would be interested in Joe Adele, who's finally put it together after how many years in the major leagues. Anyhow, I digress. I don't think they are going to trade Joe Adele. I don't think the Angels are going to trade anybody. Like, I think the Angels and Artie Moreno, who's a terrible owner, is probably thinking to themselves, you know what? We're a couple games under 500. American League sucks. Somebody will drop down us. We'll keep it as is. But they've got pieces on this team. They got guys who can get you something back. You know, you say Kikuchi will get you something back. Zach Neto. I mean, you don't think the Yankees would be falling all over themselves to get him? They get something back. Anyhow, you could see it with Alonso. That ball was ripped. Then a few innings later, he ripped the ball to left field. That was the play that Soto got doubled up on, which off the bat, when Soto gets doubled up on a line drive to left field, I think our first reaction is to say, what was he doing? You see the replay. I honestly exonerate him because he was running, which he's done a lot of this year, stealing a lot of bases, actually would steal a base an inning later or two innings later, now a career high. He was stealing second base and he slid. And then once he got up and realized, oh crap, Pete swung at it and it was a line drive right at the left fielder, Taylor Ward, it was too late, unfortunately, for him to get up and run back. But the Met offense finally breaks out for one inning out of absolute nowhere. Two outs and nobody on. Beatty gets the double. How good has Beatty been? He makes the great defensive play in this game at third base in the eighth inning when he's, I think Gary Cohen said it, basically playing high lie. He goes to the ground, makes that great pick. But I mentioned earlier how Nimmo has been one of their most consistent hitters. So is Beatty. And that double in the fifth inning with two outs and nobody on, trailing 2-0, is a huge hit. But then the bigger hit was Alvarez. And, man, how good does it feel, Hoff, to see Francisco Alvarez come back from minor leagues, have a productive game one, and then hit a game-tying two-run home run in the fifth inning? That was an awesome moment for Francisco Alvarez.
I feel like I haven't really jumped out of my seat in a while watching a Met game. I mean, listen, there's been some amazing moments, don't get me wrong, but that got me going. Watching Francisco Alvarez trot the bases, that was electric. And he just missed one the day before. So clearly something has worked, you know, whether it's just building the confidence, wherever the case is, and it was a much needed return for Francisco Alvarez.
This is a big part of the game because, you know, Beatty gets that two-out double. It's 2-0 Angels. If Alvarez grounds out or pops up, now we're in the later innings. It's the sixth inning down 2-0. I don't know what happens. I don't know if they come back. And the other thing was, if you remember, on the first pitch of that at-bat, he took a massive swing. He was swinging from his heels. And Keith Hernandez even said, you got to take a deep breath, Francisco. I mean, you can hit a home run without swinging from your heels. And he put together a good at-bat. He was behind in the count. He worked the count even and hit that two-run home run. And it looks, it's only two games because he did not play the third game of this series. It's only two games. But it really looks like the minor league trip for a month has worked. He looked great defensively, blocking balls in the dirt. He threw a guy out trying to steal. And obviously, offensively, he's been outstanding. So it feels like the magic worked of sending him down.
Yeah, and you, I think you touched on it on episode 516 when we went through Stern's audio, and he basically said, you know, Francisco Alvarez had the opportunity to take 72 hours. Like, he could have gone last minute, but he got there, he went right to work, and just attacked it. And I love to hear that because – not for nothing, but sometimes we question these young kids. Like, what, Mark Vientos, when he got sent down a couple of years ago too, what type of attitude did he have after, you know, not really getting a great opportunity? He worked his tail off and he came back, and last year he had an unbelievable season. So the fact is, this young core of players that, who knows if they're all going to stick, but the young core of players, they are working to get back in the bigs if for some reason they do scuffle.
Listen, this, a lot of the guys in the major leagues have God-given talent, maybe all of them. It's what you do with that God-given talent. It's how hard you work. And Francisco Alvarez has always been known as a hard worker, and it's great to see it paying off two games back. That was a cool moment. That was a big moment. What was also cool is that tied the game. There's still two outs. And then Ronnie Mauricio gets a base hit. Ronnie Mauricio steals second base. And Brandon Nimmo drives him in. So it goes from two out, two run home run by Alvarez, great to tie game, to instantly taking the lead. And good job by Mauricio. And also, the Mets are stealing bases at a crazy clip. It is a testament to coaching that they are just running on everybody and their big moments. You know, the Mauricio stolen base is an underrated gem from this game because Brandon Nimmo gets a base hit. Great. He's not scoring if he doesn't steal second base. So big moment by Mauricio. Big hit by Brandon Nimmo. What I'll bitch about is the fact that after they take the 3-2 lead, which is great, they had multiple scoring opportunities to bust on this game. And they failed. Let's start in the sixth inning. Leadoff walk by Soto. He steals second. Walk by Vientos. Beatty struck out in a big spot. I don't mean to pick on Beatty. He's been so good, but just to show you, they had an opportunity in the sixth. They failed. The worst one was the seventh, though. You get a leadoff error by Zach Neto when Alvarez hits a ground ball to shortstop. He just doesn't play it well, boots it. Then you get another ground ball off the bat of Ronnie Mauricio. This time you get an error by the first baseman, by Chanel. So the Angels commit two errors in a row to set up first and second, nobody out. And you've got Nimmo and you've got Lindor, Soto and Alonso. And Nimmo strikes out. Lindor strikes out. There's a wild pitch, so Soto gets walked and Pete strikes out. I mean, you have the Angels handing you the game. They're telling you it's 3-2, make it 5-2. And you got your best hitters coming up. Like, the Mets won, right? So I could easily not bring this up, but I don't believe in that. I don't believe in not talking about things just because you won, or vice versa, by the way. You know, even when they lose, I will mention good things. And that's not me shilling for them. That's me being honest. And this isn't me being negative. This is me reminding you that if the Met bullpen didn't do an outstanding job without Edwin Diaz, and they did. They did amazing. Did not give up a run, and they needed to get 10 outs. But we'd be hearkening back to this seventh inning blown opportunity. 2-1 and nobody out because of two errors. You got the top of the order coming up, and Nimmo, Lindor, and Alonso all strike out? I'm sorry. And by the way, same thing in the eighth inning. Leadoff walk to Jeff McNeil. They go to Acuna, who steals second. You got a runner on second. Beatty and Alvarez failed. And again, not picking on those guys because Alvarez had a great game. Beatty had a huge double. It's just, it's everybody. And so it was nerve-wracking because, come on, Ryan Stanek in the ninth inning, nobody had confidence. And he's nursing a one-run lead, and it should have been bigger than a one-run lead. But unfortunately, the offense missed every freaking opportunity that they had in the last three innings of this game.
But here's the thing, Evan. I don't know. You tell me if I'm wrong with this, but I felt the same way in game one on Monday, that the Mets hit a point where they take the lead and then they just get lazy. It's like they don't want to win. It's like they don't want to do enough. Like they have multiple opportunities. Everybody's got, whether it's bases loaded or runners in scoring position, like we said, and they just don't do anything with it. It's like they were lucky to be playing an Angel team that wanted to give the game away.
I don't think it's laziness or not trying. I think it's just it's a common problem all year long. They've really struggled to get the big hit. And it's a collective issue. It's not one guy. You know, I know we pick on Juan Soto because he's had such a bad year at it. But outside of Pete Alonso, basically everybody's numbers haven't been good. Lindor even acknowledged it. Like, after he got the two hits on Wednesday and the Met crowd was so great, he was talking after the game and he made a joke. He's like, I haven't had a lot of hits with guys on base. Like, he knows it. So I think it's just a collective issue that, you know, we talk about now. It's cost them games now. And we could sit here all day and say it should change, it will change. It hasn't. You know, we're over 100 games into the season, and they have been consistently a bad team with runners in scoring position. The good news is it didn't matter in this series because they won all three games. So that's great. I think the concern and the reason I bring it up and the reason other people bring it up is we know it needs to be better for them to win consistently. It needs to be better. The compliment is baseball is a team game. And guys can step up and help each other out. And I thought Rico Garcia, who's back, hello, Rico, did a really good job because he came in with a guy on base in the sixth inning, got big outs. Remember, all of this is with a one-run lead. So the Met bullpen who came in, the names I'm about to mention, it's a one-run lead. It's not a five-run lead. It's not a four-run lead. They have no cushion. No cushion whatsoever. Rico Garcia gets a big out, gets two more outs in the seventh inning. Reed Garrett comes in. Gets a big out with the tying run on second base and then pitches a 1-2-3 eighth inning. And then Ryan Stanek, like, it wasn't easy, especially when he gives up a leadoff hit. But again, with a one-run lead, gets Mike Trout, of all people, with two on and two out. So really good work by Garcia, Garrett, and Stanek making this thing hold up. Decent performance by Frankie Montas. I got to be honest with the Montas stuff. I think I would have pushed him for one more batter. His pitch count was 91. He gave up a two-out hit to Logan Ohapi at this point with a one-run lead. I think because it was Renjifo who had been owning everybody, maybe that's why Mendy said, let me show something else to Luis Renjifo because he was 2-for-2 against Montas. I don't know. I think I was more willing to push him one more batter, especially knowing the bullpen was short, but it worked. Garcia, Garrett, and Stanek were able to somehow get 10 outs and make a one-run lead hold up, which I didn't expect. I thought they were going to need more than a one-run lead for that bullpen to make that a hold up.
So two things. First of all, I'm the same way with you. When they were going to pull Montas, I'm like, you got to be kidding me. You can't pull him here. Give him one more batter. And then I go, wait a second. What if I said all season long? Once you get to that sixth inning, it's batter by batter. And once one guy goes on, pull him. So like I was like, you know what? I trust my gut, what I've said the whole time. You just – good job by Carlos Mendoza taking him out when he did. And also, you got to give props to Brett Beatty in the eighth inning because that was, what, a lot – shocking.
Great play.
Rocket to Brett Beatty. He made a nifty play at third base, get the out. Reed Garrett was like his jaw dropped on that play.
It was a great play. It was. I mean, I think, like I said, Gary Cohn described it as Beatty was playing highlight. The way he went down and was able to make that scoop. Brett Beatty has been, You know, his offense has obviously been very good. He was streaky this season, you know, up and down, up and down. His defense has been awesome. It's kind of amazing. Again, testament to hard work. You know, sometimes it's just, it's busting your ass. Like Brett Beatty becoming a really good defensive third baseman and even becoming an acceptable defensive second baseman. It's crazy. It's a testament to Beatty and the coaching staff. He's knocked one out of the park with his defense. And you can knock one out of the park and raise the apple with Takara Chuhai, a sparkling cocktail that blends real shochu spirits with the delicious flavors of fruits locally grown in Japan. It's available at Citi Field and Fuji Apple, of course, white, peach, and lemon. We have named Rico star of the series throughout every series. And sometimes it's very easy to name a Rico star of the series. It's obvious. It, you know, gives us 30 seconds. We say the obvious, we move on. Sometimes because they suck, like the three-game sweep at the hands of the Pittsburgh Pirates, you really go to the bottom of the barrel and you're like, yeah, Brandon Waddell, he kept them in one game. Let's give it to him.
Are you ready to dive into the stories, stats, and personalities that make baseball the greatest game in the world? Rob Bradford from the Baseballs and Boring podcast here, and we'll have you covered every day with podcasts that bring you closer to the action, from the bleachers to the clubhouse. Whether you're a diehard fan or just a casual observer, these conversations are aimed to educate, entertain, and most importantly, inform you. Follow the Baseballs and Boring podcast in the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
But in a series in which you sweep your opponent, and for context, the last time the Mets have swept an opponent, you got to go back to the National Series. That was right before the funk against Tampa Bay. That was the last time the Mets swept the series. In fact, they swept back-to-back series. They swept the Rockies in Colorado, and they swept the Nationals at Citi Field. Sometimes it's so difficult because you got so many great options. And so as we name our Rico star of the series, I will tell you that there are like a million options. I'm going to go through a ton of them, and then we'll decide who the Rico star of the series should be. Candidate number one, Brandon Nimmo. Brandon Nimmo had some big hits in this series. In fact, Brandon Nimmo drove in a run in all three games. Drove in a run in game one, drove in a run in game two, hit the leadoff home run that set the tone in game three. I think Brett Beatty is an absolute candidate. He hits the home run in game one that got them back in the game. They were down 4-0. Got a hit in game two, got a hit in game three, and that hit in game two, that double, was the double that set up the Francisco Alvarez game-tying home run. Speaking of Francisco Alvarez, how about him? His return from the injured list. His return from the minor leagues. He makes good defensive plays. He has a big caught stealing. He gets a double in game one that was significant. The game-tying home run in game two. He doesn't play in game three, so he impacted two of the three games, but he impacted it in a big way. Brooks Raley. I mean, Brooks Raley gets a win in game one with a clean inning, gets a hold in game three, didn't have the greatest command, but ultimately didn't give up a run over the course of two scoreless innings. Edwin Diaz. He gets a four-out save, certainly aided by some bad umpiring, but he gets a four-out save in game three. He strikes out the side, looking dominant, getting a save in game one. And I'm going to surprise you with another candidate. He's not even on the team anymore. I got to give major props to Kevin Hergett. Remember Kodai Senga's lousy performance? And then Kevin Hergett comes in and pitches 2 1/3 innings scoreless baseball to keep him in the game. Look, Lindor and Alonso didn't hit till game three. I don't think they are candidates for the Rico I'm the Man Now star of the series, but they certainly contributed to a victory in game three. So I think those are all the candidates. I think there's a lot of them. A, is there anybody I missed? And Pete, who do you think is the Rico I'm the Man Now star of the series?
Maybe I'm a sucker, but Francisco Alvarez, I don't know. Like, I feel like the two hits that he had were so impactful. You know, again, the huge double in game one, but the tying home run in game two. I know he didn't play game three, but you know what? His presence on the bench might have helped. So I'm going to give it to Francisco Alvarez.
Yeah, there's no wrong answer here. Nimmo drove in an insurance run in the eighth inning of game one. He drove in the game-winning run the RBI single we talked about in game two. And he hit the tone-setting leadoff home run in game three. I think he's a great candidate. I think it's either Edwin Diaz or it's Francisco Alvarez. I think it really is between those two guys, because Diaz striking out the side, and it was the heart of the batting order too. It was 2-3-4 with a two-run lead in the ninth inning, right after the Mets had just scored the two runs to take the lead. That's a big-ass save. Like, that's a badass save too. Not only does he get the job done, he strikes out the side. I know he was shaky in Wednesday's game, and he got lucky with the strikeout in the eighth inning, but he still got a four-out save. So I wrestle between Diaz and Alvarez. Both impacted two games because Alvarez didn't play in game three. But I would agree with you. I think it is Francisco Alvarez. I'm not saying that just based on emotion or because I want to give it to him. I do think that that home run in game two was monstrous. You know, they're down 2-0. He doesn't hit that. Who knows what the game turns into. And then you even factor in the double in the eighth inning of the opener of this series. I mean, it's a tie game. Who knows where this game is going? There's a runner on first, and he hit the crap out of that ball. I know it was a bad play by Chris Taylor, but still. Then you throw in the two walks he had, including drawing a walk that actually started the rally in the seventh inning where they came back and tied the game. That's kind of an underrated Alvarez moment. So I'd agree with you. And what a story that is. The guy gets sent down to the minor leagues. He comes back, and he's the Rico, I'm the man now star of the series. And this may surprise you. This is actually Alvarez's second. He won one all the way back in, I think it was April, when they split that four-game series against the Nationals in Washington. And Alvarez went 4-for-13 with a home run. So Francisco Alvarez, I agree with you, Hoff, is our Rico, I'm the man now star of the series.
And can I just say the reason why I wouldn't go Edwin Diaz anyway, and I know that you already made the decision, so that's fine, but like, he's starting to hit people a lot lately, and that's scaring me. That I think it's a third hit batter in like three games.
Yeah, but I'm not defending his wildness from game three. I'm merely saying he came into two games. He got two saves. He didn't give up a run. It wasn't easy in game three, but game one, it was easy. He struck out the side. Like, do you get extra points for being really dominant and not giving us stress? Not really. Did you get the job done? 2 1/3 innings, zero runs, two saves. Like, that's pretty good. That's probably as good as it's going to get for a closer in a three-game series, no?
No, it is. No. Listen, again, I'm not complaining too much. I'm just pointing out something that I saw the past few games with him, and it could be turning into a habit that I don't like. Like, don't hit anybody anymore.
I get it, but in the middle of those two games you're talking about, he struck out the side on like 10 pitches. Are we just going to ignore how freaking dominant he looked in that game?
Oh, no, no. I'm not going to ignore it. I'm not going to ignore it. No, not at all.
Now, when you win a series 3-0, picking the net negative is a little bit challenging. I think Francisco Lindor had a great chance to win this until he got two hits in the finale of this series. I think Pete Alonso had a chance to win this. I think Juan Soto could win this. Juan Soto was 1-for-9 in this series. Lindor was 2-for-13. Alonso was 2-for-11. Those hits came, obviously, in the final game of this series. I think that the Rico net negative, and I love the guy, but we got to be honest, is Kodai Senga. I mean, Kodai Senga really put them behind the eight ball very early in game one. He gives up the home run to Logan Ohapi. He can't get through the third inning, came very close to getting through the third inning by striking out Mike Trout, but he walked him, gives up a double to Taylor Ward, gives up another hit, ends up pitching three innings and allowing four runs and walking three guys, puts a strain on the bullpen by getting knocked out so early. I think it's clearly Kodai Senga. For the very first time, he's never won a net negative award. And in fact, most of the time, it's not starting pitchers. I'm looking at our history. We've had relievers. But believe it or not, Kodai Senga is actually going to be the first starting pitcher to win the net negative. Congratulations to him.
Yeah, you know what? I realized the net negative usually goes to a relief pitcher who we get frustrated with because he blew up the game, so we gave it to him. Like, we make it like an obvious thing. Like, Brad Zaban, I believe, has a couple.
Yes.
Stanek's definitely had a couple. Can I tell you something? I mean, I'd fight you for one guy just because I feel like we got to mention his name because he's already gone, and it's so upsetting to me. Chris Devinsky, I thought he pitched rather well, but he did give up a run. So maybe you want to just, you know, give him a parting gift as he got DFA'd?
No. I'm not going to kill Chris. Look, Chris Devinsky, I'll tell you this. I am surprised that they got rid of Chris Devinsky. We said on the last Rico, wow, he's actually pitched well. He could eventually enter the circle of trust. He came in the sixth inning of a game with a runner on first and one out, and he got two big outs. And then he struggled in the seventh inning, no question about it. I was more mad at Mendy for keeping him in the game as long as he did. I thought after he gave up the hit to Neto and he was erased on a cost stealing, and then he walks Chanel on four pitches, he should have been taken out, and he kept him in, and he hit a batter, and he kept him in, and he faced Taylor Ward and gave up another hit. Like, to me, that was really about Mendy keeping him in the game too long. But, you know, I'm glad you mentioned Devinsky being DFA'd, because the handling of the bullpen is so interesting. Like, to me, I would have looked at, you know, Hergett and Carrillo and said, those are the guys I may get rid of. No offense to Hergett, because he obviously contributed big time in game one. But Alex Carrillo, like, why is he on this team? Like, that would have been the thing I looked at upon bringing Rico Garcia back. Like, I was surprised that they got rid of Chris Devinsky. And look, at this point, Carrillo still being on the roster stuns me. Like, I don't know. I don't know how he's still here. Like, Jose Buteau comes back, and somehow Carrillo is surviving all of this. They got rid of Justin Garza, who was here, never pitched, but was added to the roster. I don't understand Carrillo being here and Devinsky not being here.
I think that we need to have like an insider with when it comes down to waivers, free agents, DFAs, and all this other nonsense, because there is a rotation. I mean, we've gone through Rico Garcia how many times? We've gone through Devinsky. I think it got DFA'd at least one other time this season. If you go through these pitchers, it's numerous occasions that they've been called up, DFA'd, returned to, called up, DFA'd, returned.
Which is why Devinsky may be back. Like, I'm not screaming about it. Like, he could be back next week. I'm more surprised by it. That's all. Just,
right.
Hey, if I was going to clear a roster spot for so-and-so, Alex Carrillo surviving all of this is surprising. Let's play a game, speaking of pitchers. It's a fun game.
Okay.
How many pitchers have the Mets? In fact, before I tell you the answer, I'm going to give you context. In 2024, a year ago, the Mets used 34 different pitchers. Okay. This is starters, relievers.
Okay.
Throwing a pitch, not being on the roster, throwing a pitch. They used 34 different pitchers. Two, I could add to that, were position players, but I'm not going to include those guys. So 36 guys actually threw pitches for the New York Mets last year, but 34 of them were pitchers. Okay. How many have they used in 2025? All right, context being, they used 34 in 24. We are in mid-July, late July of 25. What is that number?
I'm pretty sure that the starting pitchers, they've used about 10 or 11 already, if I'm correct. I think I'm accurate with that.
Do you want me to give you the answer to that?
Yes.
They have started, okay, 13 different guys, but two of those guys I would classify as relievers.
Right, Brazaban and who's the other guy? Waddell?
No, because I'd include him as a starter because he can start. I forget the other guy I'm thinking of. It was Brazaban and somebody else, but either way, 11 true starters and then two openers.
Okay. So that being said, you got those are 13 pitchers already. I'm saying relief pitchers, you're talking you've had at least 15 guys, saying 26 people, 26 already.
By the way, the other guy, just to clarify, the other reliever who started a game was Chris Devinsky, who we were just talking about.
I should have known that.
So your guess is 25. Again, last year, the number
26.
Was
26. 26, I'm saying. 20, okay. 26.
Last year, the total was 34. This year, this year, they've already surpassed it.
No.
36. Isn't that crazy?
It's terrible.
The Mets have used 36 different. And by the way, if I want to include position players, it's actually 38. But I'm throwing that out. Like, we don't need that. Okay. We don't need a position player pitching to count. You know, Travis Jankowski ain't counted on this list. They have used more guys this season to pitch than they used last year. 36 this year, 34 last year. Obviously, that number is going to go up because they will add guys at the trade deadline, or there'll be young guys that they call up. You know, if they use any of their starting pitching prospects that have not been called up yet, that number's passing 40 easily. And last year it was 34. Isn't that crazy?
That's Yeah, that's too much, man. No, don't. I understand there's reasons for it. There's injuries, but the bullpen is more just like we need fresher arms. Am I wrong with that?
I think a lot of it is injuries, like you said. I think a lot of that is we just need fresher arms. A lot of that is ineffectiveness. Like, hey, we tried this guy. He's not that good. I think there's a few reasons lead to that.
Yeah, but then they bring him back.
Right, they recycle him.
I don't get it.
Like Rico Garcia. He's gone. He's back. He's gone again. He's back. Yeah, it is kind of crazy.
It's like a dating game. It's like you break up, you're on again, you're off again. You're on again, you're off again. It's like I just can't quit you. I can't quit Dickie Lovelady.
Yeah, he's one of the guys. David Stearns is sort of right about something. You know, we played on episode 516, his press conference, and I know some Met fans were taken back by the lack of urgency in adding a bat. And I agree. I disagree with David. Like, I would be aggressive in adding a bat. But the bullpen is the top priority. Like, it just is. Now, if you want to morph that into, well, it's starting pitching, and then I'm going to move Clay Holmes to the bullpen, you're basically answering the same question. You're just getting there differently. You know, if your strategy is, hey, the Mets are now connected to Dylan Cease, which they are. We'll spend more time on that on our trade deadline edition of Rico Bronya, which we will be posting on Thursday, a week before the trade deadline. So if you're listening to us on Thursday, that's later today at some point. We'll talk more about it. But part of the appeal of trading for a guy like Dylan Cease or trading for a starting pitcher is not only that guy's an upgrade, which it would be, but it's also, hey, one of our bullpen options can be a guy like Clay Holmes. And I totally get that. But either way, I look at this bullpen. They need help. Like, I can look at the offense. And I know it's being optimistic to do it, but just hear me out. I can look at the offense and rationalize why they'll be fine. I can rationalize Beatty's been great. Vientos is going to get hot. Winker's coming back. Marte's already back. They're going to hit with runners in scoring position. They will be fine. I can rationalize the rotation. I can rationalize something I said the other day. Manaea looks great. Peterson's been reliable. Senga's mostly good. What a great top three. It's very tough to rationalize the bullpen. You know, Brooks Raley looks good. Garrett's been up and down. Brazoban's been up and down. Stanek's been up and down. Diaz is great. They need arms out of the bullpen. And I would like, and I know it's going to be costly, I admit this, I would like to go big game hunting, though. Like settling for lottery tickets, which they did last year. I get why you do it, and I get why they did it last year, because there was less kind of belief in the team. But this year, there's more belief in the team. This year, you've got Juan Soto in his prime. The other thing is this year, you've got Edwin Diaz, who's going to opt out. Like, I didn't know in March if Edwin was going to opt out. We talked about it. We didn't know. Oh, dude, of course he's going to opt out. He's having a ridiculous season. He's going to cash out on it. So trading for Duran or Clase would be so amazing because it does two things. It forms a super pen, which, sign me up. I mean, let's go. It gives this team a great chance to win when you got a back end of the bullpen that features two elite level closers. And it also protects you. It also puts you in a spot where, this may sound crazy, but let's say you trade for Clase. Let's say, and it would cost a lot, Ronnie Mauricio plus. I acknowledge it's a high price tag. You trade for Clase. Now you have a super bullpen. Diaz opts out, but hey, don't worry. They work out a deal. And the Mets keep Edwin Diaz. It's not even crazy next year to say, you know what, screw it. We'll trade Clase. We rented him. He had a great year for us. He protected us in case we lost Diaz. We kept Diaz. Screw it. He's a reliever. He's got great value. He still has team control. We'll send him out again. Like, that's not crazy. So I think it does two things if these guys are available. I mean, that's the other thing. Like, the Guardians and the Twins don't have to trade these guys. But if they did, it gives you the best chance to win this year. It protects you next year. I'm not going to hate lottery tickets off, but that's not like the goal move to me if I'm David Stearns at the trade deadline.
Yeah, but and this is where I agree with you is, like, first of all, you just said, like, we were talking about how the offense is all going to click. I have an issue right now at third base and even second base too, but really third base. You have three guys fighting for one job, and the fact is that we keep on, like, the roster changes every day. Is it Vientos? Is it Beatty? Is it Mauricio? And everyone keeps on interchanging. And at some point in time, it's like fantasy baseball where it's like, oh, I don't know who to play. Play the hot hand. Play the guy
play the you hot think hand, is going to yeah.
play the guy, but play the guy you think is going to do well. And that doesn't always work out, though. And eventually you miss, oh, well, this guy would have had a better opportunity versus this guy. We missed out because we're too busy overthinking. Sometimes you just got to commit and say, you know what? Brett Beatty is our everyday third baseman. End of story, move forward, trade the other guy, and help us in another area. Bullpen, like you said, is a number one need. Or the starting pitching, which I think is you can kill two birds with one stone. If you get a starting pitcher who can go 6 to 7 innings deep every single game, because like you said, Clay Holmes could go to the bullpen, and then you've just kind of shifted everything, and you've shortened that game down.
I have an issue, and I admit it. Like, I'm going to admit a problem I have, and maybe you can help me with this.
Yeah.
I'm not against rentals, okay? Rentals are a big part of baseball, and sometimes rentals win you a world championship. Like, rentals are really good, but I'm scared of rentals. And so when you talk about starting pitchers, they're not all the same. So let's take Dylan Cease and let's take Mitch Keller. Let's take the two guys that could be traded. Dylan Cease is a rental, and I get why the Padres may consider moving him, but also acquiring a pitcher and still trying to compete. It's a weird thing, but I get it. I'm also not afraid of Dylan Cease's numbers. I know he's got a terrible ERA, but you look closer at it, like, he can turn it around easily. Like, his strikeouts are fine. His walks are still down. His FIP is pretty good, which I don't want to get nuts about, but bottom line is I'm not scared of his ERA. I don't think, like, Dylan Cease is cooked or anything like that. So I don't dislike him as a pitcher, but he's a rental, like 1,000% a rental. The Mets are not signing Dylan Cease to a 6-year contract. They're not. So eyes wide open. If they trade for him, they are renting him. If you trade Ronnie Mauricio for Dylan Cease, which, by the way, I could see the Padres doing straight up. You know, you get yourself a switch hitting stud prospect for a freaking rental. Maybe that happens. And what scares me is that you trade for Dylan Cease. There are 2 months left in the season. It's 8 starts. That's what it is. It's 8 starts. And then it's the postseason. And if it works and he's dominant in the postseason, which he wasn't last year, but let's say he is, and you win a World Series, of course it's well worth it. Like, we obviously, but you're trading such a good prospect for such a little amount of performance. You trade for Keller, he's in your rotation for the next multiple years. And so now you've kind of knotted a rotation spot. And so I'm afraid of trading for Dylan Cease if it involves a big prospect, because I know I'm literally giving that prospect away for 2 months of somebody. And 2 months of somebody who is a starting pitcher, which means they're only pitching once a week.
It's a tough sell. I don't think I would do it for Dylan Cease. I don't really know who I'd do sell Ronnie Mauricio for, because I think he's the best of those guys.
Sandy Alcantara.
Yeah, I know. And listen, he had a good game today. He
went 7 innings. Yep.
Yeah, I mean, it was much needed, but it's been few and far between. Can he be consistent? Can the Mets say, hey, we found something with him that it, we'll just fix a couple things, and he'll be back to a Cy Young level, you know?
We'll do a lot more on this on our trade deadline, Rico. Let me get to some of your emails, to ricob@gmail.com. Greg writes, guys, don't know if you saw Francisco Lindor's postgame interview, but I loved when he said, quote, when you're good, you're good. When you suck, you suck. Referring to him breaking his 0 for 31 slump that they kept asking about over and over again. Glad to see him bust that. Would be great to see Soto and Alonso get hot with him. I actually have that clip. I have it on my phone, so I'm not sure how well it would sound, but Yeah, I did watch his post game, and that line stuck with me too, Greg. So hopefully you guys will hear it. Let me give it a try.
You do when you suck, you suck. That's what it is.
You hear that one, Pete?
Oh, I heard it all right.
Yeah. One more time.
You do when you suck, you suck. It is what it is.
They should make that a t-shirt. You know, when you're good, you're good. When you suck, it is what it is.
Do you want to make that for the Rico Bronya, the next Rico Bronya t-shirt? We could do that.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
I think that makes sense.
When you suck, you suck. When you're good, you're good.
That's right. Dan writes, coming off four in a row that has everyone thinking you're straightening yourself out, we now head into a nine-game stretch against two teams hunting them in the wild card race, six being on the road where they've struggled all year, and throw in having to battle the West Coast voodoo just to top it off. You could make the argument when we look back, this might end up being the biggest stretch of the season. You have your young kids in bottom of the lineup showing life, the top guys besides Soto supposedly snapping out of it in the last game. And when you're playing teams fighting for playoff spots and you're the team you tell everyone you are, you have to step up and take control of one of those slots when you have a golden opportunity right in front of you. You do that, and then you can really start setting your sights on the division. If you don't, then you throw yourself right back into the jumble of teams that are chasing you, and almost likely without the tiebreak advantage, which was the reason you even got into the dance last year. The kids who are getting all this pub need to prove that they aren't going to fall back into the suck vortex during these types of games, and the team as a whole needs to show that they can actually play well away from City. 4-11 in their last 15 road games, especially against peer-tier competition. Starting Friday, things get serious. It is a very good point by Dan. Let's take a look at this schedule. And tiebreakers matter, and making the playoffs matter. I know that they're right there in the National League East. I know they're right there to potentially jumping up to a first-round bye. We get it. They're closer to that than they are falling out of the playoffs. But you got to secure a playoff spot. As of this recording right now, the San Francisco Giants, the team they're going to face on Friday, is the number one wild card team. I'm sorry, the number one team out of the postseason. So if your goal is, hey, we just need to make the playoffs, who would breathe down our neck and take a playoff spot away? It's actually the Giants, not the Padres, because the Padres are a wild card team. They're the third wild card team. The Giants are the first team out. They're 54-49, which means the Mets go into this with a five-game lead. If you struggle against the Giants, not only do you allow them the chance to take that tiebreaker, but this thing gets tighter. And so I agree, these are big games. Obviously, our sights are on the Phillies and getting a number one seed or a number two seed, but at the bare minimum, you want to also make sure you got a playoff spot locked up. So from that standpoint, these games are big. They are not going to have the starting pitching edge at the beginning of this series. They have to face Logan Webb, who for my money is one of the best. He's one of the best pitchers in baseball. We talk about what an ace is. An ace is reliability. An ace is somebody that goes deep into games. Logan Webb fits that. They got to deal with Robbie Ray on Saturday. It's unknown who's going to pitch on Sunday. But either way, the series starts having to face two tough cookies in Webb and Ray. It's going to be Holmes, Peterson, and Senga, and then the Padres series. And the Padres are another one of those teams. Mets are 3.5 up on them. They are a wild card team, but again, you're trying to make sure you get in. Who knows if the Padres drop at some point, and they're the team you got to beat out to make the playoffs. And then, yes, three more with the Giants at City after an off day. These are not important games. And the road thing is really weird. Like, why do the Mets struggle on the road? They did win 2 out of 3 against Kansas City, but before that, they lost the series to the Orioles. They got swept by the Pirates. They lost the series to the Phillies. They got swept by the Braves. They did sweep the Rockies, so that was good. But that was back in early June. I think the road-home thing is a coincidence. I really do. Now, I think they get some juice from the crowds at City. I mean, the crowds have been amazing. We could do a whole podcast about that, how the Mets are drawing 40,000 people a night and the place is jumping. But yes, this is an important stretch for this team. 3 in San Francisco, 3 in San Diego. I could be very conservative and say, give me a split. I kind of want more than that. Now, this team has played average baseball for a while. How about they get hot? How about they build off of sweeping the Angels? So I want to, you know, say 4 out of 6. That's what I want to say. Go win both these series. Go beat the Giants, who are struggling. Go beat the Padres. These are teams that you're better than, according to the standings. Go beat them. Go win 4 out of 6. And then they got the Giants and the Guardians at home at Citi Field. And by that point, the trade deadline has passed. So by the time they get out of this West Coast trip, there will be differences on this team. We'll spend a lot of time talking about the trade deadline on episode 518. We will go through relief pitchers, starting pitchers, bats, price tags, and all of that. And then our expectations for what they need to do at the trade deadline. You have any thoughts on that? Obviously, you can send it to us, thericob@gmail.com.
I just want to say, as of this taping, we were 2 outs away from the Mets being back in first place, but we're sitting in the bottom of the 10th in Philly, and it's still 7-7. So we were very close to being back on top.
Yeah, it's tight, man. This NL East race has been very tight between the Mets and the Phillies. And you got the Brewers and the Cubs battling in the Central. The Dodgers cooled off. So the standings, not just making the playoffs, but the very tippy top of it, is actually very close. The Mets are only 2.5 games behind the Brewers for the best record in the league. So despite all of this, and despite us talking about the Giants and the Padres at the bottom of the playoff race, again, the Mets are closer to the number one seed than they are missing the playoffs. It is a very tight kind of standings right now in the National League.
Is it safe to say that the Braves are dead?
So funny you say that. So earlier today, off air, I was talking to the executive producer of Evan and Tiki, Tommy Lugauer, and I hit the talk back button. That's the button where I could just talk to him. And I said, Tommy, I got to tell you something. He said, what? I said, I'm finally ready to declare the Braves dead. So it took me longer than you, Hoff. It took me longer than Sal, that's for sure. But at 13 games under 500 and 10.5 games out of a playoff spot, the Atlanta Braves are dead. Doesn't mean they won't beat the Mets when they face them. Just means they're dead.
Let's pop a Mio sparkling sake.
Yes.
In celebration.
Let us celebrate the fact that the Atlanta Braves are dead. Great. Now, that makes me happy. Now, we got to take care of business. Now, we got to do what we got to do. We appreciate you listening and downloading the Rico Bronya. We'll have our trade deadline issue posted at some point on Thursday night. And maybe we'll stay up really late for the Giant Mets series and do some very, 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 very late night Rico Bronyas. All I can think about is if I went to Europe while the Mets were on a West Coast trip, the 10 o'clock game would start at 4 a.m. And there's a part of me that was like, I kind of prefer that. I would just wake up early and watch the Mets, which I guess I was doing anyway on DVR. I guess when your games are starting at such a crazy time and you're going to wake up and watch it on DVR, what's the difference? If it's 1 a.m., 4 a.m., or 3 a.m., I guess it doesn't make a difference. Either way, thank you very much for listening and downloading another edition of Rico Bronya.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Rico Bronya podcast. It's amazing, isn't it? Make sure you download it now to keep it on you at all times.
Are you ready to dive into the stories, stats, and personalities that make baseball the greatest game in the world? Rob Bradford from the Baseballs and Boring podcast here, and we'll have you covered every day with podcasts that bring you closer to the action, from the bleachers to the clubhouse. Whether you're a diehard fan or just a casual observer, these conversations are aimed to educate, entertain, and most importantly, inform you. Follow the Baseballs and Boring podcast in the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.